it had to be something that had a bit of meaning for me to go again.
Okay.
And like, this was the obvious one. It was like, this industry is screwed, like, right? And nobody is taking the right approach as far as I was concerned.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, we're chatting to Barry Lunn, the founder of Provisio. But first, a couple of little announcements. I've got a big giveaway for you. We've 10 tickets to the Dublin Tech Summit, which is coming up on June 17th. Some of the world's best entrepreneurs are speaking at it, and I'm also speaking at it too. So to win, simply share your favorite episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast on social media and tag me. It's that easy. Pick your favorite, share it through Spotify or Apple, and then put it onto Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, wherever you do your socials. And just remember to tag me and the Entrepreneur Experiment. It's that easy. The Entrepreneur Experiment community is open for new members. We're ramping up our in-person events. We have our first in-person meetup tomorrow. We are going golfing. So if you're interested, it's 99 euros for the year. We're now open for membership. We're going to be ramping up a lot of events, both online and offline, crucially, because I think the next couple of years are going to be pretty tough for everybody. And the ones that will be successful are the ones with a strong support network around them. So do consider joining. Go to mrgaryfox.com. Now on to Barry Lunn. I always take notes, right? During each chat, I take notes of a little notebook and I take notes as, you know, things that interest me or interesting things to pull out later. And I had to stop during this interview because I had to focus exclusively on what Barry was saying. It was that interesting and it was also that captivating. My final note, which gives you an insight into today's chat, is a pragmatist with a wild vision. That is Barry Lunn and this is my chat with him. Barry, welcome to the pod.
Cheers, Gary. Good to be here.
Great to chat to you.
And you?
Visiting us from sunny Limerick.
Absolutely. It's always sunny in Limerick. People don't realise that, but it actually is always sunny in Limerick.
It's so a secret. There you go. Well, you've just let the cat out of the bag there.
They'll all be on now. They're all moving down there anyway. They've realised, you know.
All the digital nomads are going to be flocking to Limerick.
It isn't as attractive anymore, you know.
It's not going to be Bali. It's going to be Costa del Limerick.
Yeah, yeah.
Welcome to the pod, Barry. It's great to chat to you. Just give us a quick outline of what you do.
What to do? So I guess today I'm the founder and CEO of Provisio. So we're essentially we work in the automotive space, and we're working on the longest running global pandemic in human history, car crashes, and why we kill ourselves. 1.35 million people killed every year. 50 million more seriously injured, maimed, cost of a couple of trillion to the global economy. Pretty big problem. So, you know, we're going through a pandemic at the moment and hopefully coming out the other end of it. And yet this one continues and it hasn't changed in the last 20 years. People think tech has done this and that. It hasn't. The median number is pretty much the same. So that's what we started looking at. Could we solve that? Whether we're right or wrong, it kind of doesn't matter. If you thought tomorrow you had the vaccine for COVID-19, would you keep it in your on your shelf or would you try and get it out there? And that's basically what we're doing. I'm delusional enough to think we can solve road crashes. And we're trying to roll that out right now.
It's kind of one of those no-brainer problems, right? I think everyone listening is going to go, yeah. It's a problem.
Unfortunately, it's a lot of brainers' problems.
Yeah. But how do you get
a lot of brains to solve it?
How do you get the confidence to look at a global problem and go, I'll have a crack at it?
There's no confidence. I never said I was the guy with that. it's actually being dumb helps, being the dumbest lad in the room and knowing a lot of smart people. So that's kind of always been my approach. And so really the confidence came from working in that industry for quite some time, but working more in imaging and radar and all that fun stuff with aero defense and that, and seeing the technology applied somewhere else and knowing, you know, in theory, it works, right? So could we bring that tech to the automotive space as opposed to could we invent something out of the air? And I suppose then there's a lot of things have happened over the last number of years as well, which I think make it look more possible. And there's also been the massive failing of the autonomous industry and let's not call it anything else, right? I've worked in it for the last 6 or 7 years and on probably the most advanced autonomous program in the world for a while. And it's a complete failure, right? Okay, so we have no autonomy. We're nowhere near it, realistically. So there was that side of it as well, of kind of going, because if you look at the industry, right, autonomy basically said autonomy is going to be the solution. So if everyone's driving autonomous vehicles, we will solve the safety problem. Mm-hmm. We're taking the opposite approach. We're saying solve the safety problem and autonomy will come. And that's really all we're doing. We're just looking at it from the other side. And it as it turned out, it's the edge cases. I kind of, you know, been saying it for quite a number of years that it was the edge cases was going to kill everyone. Mm. It's really easy to make a car drive around in circles, right? On a track or in Arizona with the perfect optical environment, dry air. But it's really bloody difficult to do it in wet and windy Stoke, as they say. So that's where we're taking the approach. So I think it's the other big thing in terms of the confidence thing. One thing I've learned to do is kind of, I'm dyslexic, so I have a dyslexic mindset. So I can always see the kind of the outcome. I feel like I know how it's going to end, but then breaking it down into really small parts and saying, right, let's solve this bit. Then if that bit will unlock that bit and work through it that way. And look, that's how I think we'll get there.
So you're telling me an autonomous car is not going to drive me to Nina in the next couple of years?
I don't think an autonomous car is going to drive you to Nina ever, because there's a built-in intelligence there that'll say, why the hell would you want to go to Nina? There you go. I know that's not on. That's not on. For a Limerick, it's very rare.
I was going to say now.
People have a place that they can get down on, but Nina's one of them. So you're going to get it, Gary. Sorry.
Talk to me about that. The autonomous, not Nina now. We've done enough bashing on Nina. Talk to me about that. You say it's a fail. It's failed.
Well, it has. I mean, this isn't my opinion. There's no, where are these autonomous vehicles that we're all going to be on the road in 2018, then it was 2019, then it was 2020, 2021. Look, by the way, the industry all knew it was going to fail. Like, I've been lucky enough to work with the best, right? So they all knew it wasn't going to happen. But you have to pitch this vision, or otherwise, why would the world invest $100 billion, which is what's gone into this space, right? So it's cost. When you have something that costs that much and requires, you know, so much buy-in from insurance, from public policymakers and all that, you have to sell them the dream, right? And so that's what was pitched. But the approach was kind of wrong from the beginning. And look, it's not just me. Loads of people in this space predicted we'd get to this level 2 autonomy and then everyone would fall off a cliff. And that's exactly what's happened. Like, everyone's kind of in the same place. Some people have a bit more level 2 autonomy and some people are, you know, nudging into level 3 in certain scenarios. Realistically, everyone's stuck there. And so I think it's good. The industry is now resetting. We're getting a lot of safety washing, which is great, where they're starting to go, oh no, it was really all about safety from the beginning. But also because it's failed, they're now readdressing the sensors, they're readdressing the entire approach and saying, right, that failed. Let's now try and this tends to happen in a lot of blue sky industries. It's now let's look at, okay, what do we actually need? Now they know an awful lot more about the problem. What do we actually need to solve that problem? And that is like just things like long range sensing that works in inclement weather conditions. I often make the analogy that, like, what drove me crazy, coming from an aero defense background, what drove me crazy about the autonomous vehicle industry was it was so dominated by computer science people, right? It was a real Silicon Valley thing.
Yeah.
But the problem was much closer to an aero defense problem, right? And if you went to NASA tomorrow and you said, I have a brilliant idea for a shuttle. Now, it won't work in space, right? But give us a few $100 million and we'll work that bit out later. They'd laugh you out of the building, right? But that's exactly what the computer science industry did in automotive vehicles. And they took a real, so the computer science approach, so air defense approach is, you look at the worst possible scenario. What's the worst weather conditions? What's the worst everything? And you say, right, can it work in that? And then work back from there. And you choose all your materials appropriately and your software and everything like that. And that's why they tend to be like 20-year-old tech that goes on a satellite that goes up because it needs to survive. The autonomous industry started like most computer science people would, you know, hello world, right? So they made a very, very simple, oh, look, now we can get the car to drive around in a circle. Now we can do it in a more complex circle. And like you'd all this bizarre stuff like Google Car before it was Waymo, you know, writing reports just a couple of years ago saying, and of course the Google Car pulls over when it rains. And like you're in Ireland going, are you for real? Like, come on, why did you even put a sensor on there that can't behave in the rain? You know, that kind of way. So I just think that's all been reset now. Like even you look at Waymo, for example. So like look at the spec of what they had on the vehicle day one versus what they're putting on there now. And like they've had to build a bunch of that tech themselves from the ground up because it didn't exist. And this was kind of my argument. Like, and it's often said, you know, oh, we're going to update that over the air, you know, that kind of way. And then we'll unlock it. You can't update physics over the air, right? And if the hardware isn't there, it ain't going to be updated by any software. And so I think we're seeing that change now. It's lovely to see like the likes of Waymo, Cruise, Argo, Aurora. They're now putting on capability on their vehicles that could unlock it, right? That's the way I look at it. They can definitely get there. But they're also not talking about tomorrow. You know what I mean? Mm. This is a process. And we've gotten rid of this level zero to level five nonsense. Obviously, Tesla fans still talk about it. But everyone else has gotten over that. Because that was never what it was designed. Level zero to level five was never meant to be like a Microsoft progress bar from like, you know, we've no autonomy to full autonomy, right? It was meant to be, in certain scenarios, it's level zero. In other scenarios, it's level four. In these scenarios, it's level two. That's the idea. And that's the way it will be. You know what I mean? And so there will be no level five solution. There will be solutions with level two, level three, and level five capability that start to roll out in the road. And that's where it's headed,
I guess,
in my opinion.
Yeah, it makes total sense. Let's talk about the elephant in the room, Elon, and his predictions. He's probably driving most of those predictions, I guess, as you were talking to me there.
He didn't drive the early ones, right? Don't forget, Elon didn't talk about, because he had other stuff to talk about in the beginning just to survive, right? So like his full self-driving thing is relatively new in the Elonomics. It was just a new thing to make sense of what he's doing, right? So it was the big boys, it was the Googles, it was these guys at the beginning that were saying we're going to have this and we're going to solve that and all that fun stuff. And look, it can look like that in paper, and I think that should be okay as well, because I think if we vilify people, like, then no one ever admits their mistakes, you know what I mean? And you get into that awful position. And that's where Waymo has been in a nice position up to now. Now they have proper investors, they kind of have to perform. But up till then, they could do lots of experiments. Tesla and Elon, it's weird coming from an air defense background because I'm a bit of an Elon fan, you know what I mean? And SpaceX is cool. And look, nobody does kind of vertical integration better, you know what I mean? Of putting stuff that exists and just putting it together, like not overthinking it, doesn't have to be too smart. Let's just, you know, instead of, you know, doing a rocket four times as good, let's just strap four rockets together. You know, that's not rocket science, but it is in, like, NASA wouldn't do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that stuff is interesting. But the whole Tesla thing, like the Tesla story is much longer, and it's almost like, you know, when you're a kid and you tell a lie, right? And you get caught out, right? So, you know, 99% of kids will go, all right, hands up. You know what I mean? The entrepreneur is the guy that goes, no, I'll show you, right? That lie isn't a lie. And then you have another lie that builds on top of that. And really, that's Tesla has kind of had to create that reality distortion field, because it's kind of a case of, well, it was the only way to sustain it, right? And in the early days, you could kind of forgive that and you'd go, well, it gets EVs and look what he's done, right? Like GM killed EVs years ago, right? So he's got EVs back in the mainstream. Now everyone's going to be using EVs. That's a monster success. But the full self-drive thing is a load of nonsense. And no one knows that better than Elon. You know what I mean? I mean, the Tesla have never been anywhere near and never had the hardware on the vehicle to ever get anywhere near full self-driving. I mean, the idea that you could do it with a light-based system like just cameras, like Elon knows that's nonsense, right? So, and now he's taking out the radars out of the vehicles in North America, but well, if you don't need them, why not take them out worldwide? And look, we have a crunch at the minute with supply and with sensors and all that fun stuff. So it is a nightmare out there. I just, you know, at this stage, and obviously talking to other people in this industry, like it's kind of got to the place where you're kind of going, oh God, what's he saying now? You're almost embarrassed. Like you're almost embarrassed because it's often, and then you've, This thing has been built up, the fake news around this. And that's I just used the word fake news in this, in real world. But anyway, it is what it is. Like all these fake blogs, all this, you know, all the fanboys on Reddit and all that crap are feeding into this and the stock price. And it's awful, like, cause it shouldn't get to a place where you start testing tech on the roads. This is something like, this is serious shit. Like this kills 1.35 million people every year, right? This is serious. Like don't call something ludicrous mode. You know what I mean? I just, I hate that whole bro culture anyway, says I wearing a baseball cap. but you know what I mean? It's just something distasteful about it. You know what I mean? It's serious. These things are like, they're dangerous, right? Cars are dangerous. And people buying that hype, we've seen what happens, right? We've seen, you know, some of the crashes. And don't get me wrong, like a Tesla, and this is, we have to be very careful here because the rest of the OEMs are kind of, you know, the big boys are sitting back going, let's let him, you know, hang himself on his own petard. But the Tesla is still safer than most of the vehicles on the road, right? It's just that its drivers now are doing some unsafe things because they've been fed some nonsense on a forum, right? That says it's capable, or they think it's nearly. Like there's a huge amount of people believe that, you know, Tesla would be fully self-driving if it wasn't for those pesky regulators and stuff like that. And that's nonsense. And it suits them to feed that beast. And it's worked with the share price, whatever the hell is going on there. But in terms of when you come to autonomy, and again, like that's not really our space. I mean, we do work with some of those groups, but our space is getting the tech onto everyone's car, right? Like the next 20 years, we're going to be sharing the roads no matter what, right? Like the old vehicles aren't just going to disappear off the road. So like our focus is on building, you know, tech at a price point that it can be ubiquitous, that it can go into everyone's vehicle, stop the carnage, and then work up to the autonomy. And that takes time, right? And it shouldn't be based on just getting enough money to get through the next quarter.
Yeah, you're not long on the share price then.
I'm not short on it either, though. I don't ever want to be that guy, you know what I mean, betting against another entrepreneur. But I did own Tesla shares, and I no longer own Tesla shares. Like it's like I just couldn't be dealing with it, you know, that kind of way. It's, but don't get me wrong, it could be worse. I could own a Tesla vehicle. Like those are the real, they're the guys that are really going to get caught here. You know what I mean? Because it's grand. Their early customers didn't matter, right? So early Tesla customers, if you that much money to spend on EV roadster, it didn't kind of matter. But as the price point has come down, it starts to feel much more like a Ponzi scheme, you know, that kind of way. And that's I'm so uncomfortable with it. Like I just find the whole thing a bit like, oh God. And yeah, so I actually tend to avoid it. I tend to avoid Tesla conversations, says I, after 10 minutes of rattling on about it.
Well, I brought you down the road. Sorry. I couldn't help myself as you went off on that beautiful tangent there.
We take a quick break from today's chat to talk about our partners for season 6, kiriscarstore.ie. That's carstore.ie. They're an incredible family-owned Irish brand, and that is why I love partnering with them. They have an incredible service. As the world's reopening, you might need a new car, you might need to trade up the old one, or you might even need to get your first car. Go to carstore.ie. You can search over 700 cars, and you can do it all online. that is the beauty here. 24/7, you go online, you pick out the car. I like that one. Okay. You can then book a virtual viewing. You can do it through your phone. You don't have to leave the house. You can go, okay, I like that one. We're going to buy it. The beauty is they'll deliver it anywhere in Ireland for you. And if you don't like it, you can return it. No hassle. Go check them out. They're incredible people. It's a brilliant business. It's carstore.ie, or you can click the link in the description below. Now back to today's chat.
Bring me back to the start, Barry, because how does a Limerick man go into what you've gone into? So bring me back to the very start.
I was born in a stable. I'm from Limerick. Yeah, I'm from like Carrick and Lish out the road here. That was all good place to grow up. Like, despite, you know, pubble in this indexes that would say, you know, it was like Beirut or whatever. You know what I mean? It's really good. Actually, it's an interesting one, because you often think back on this stuff. Like when I was growing up, like, it was like, so I'm 70s, 80s kid. You know what I mean? So like, one of my mates actually sent a picture recently of, you know, from school or whatever. And I said something to him about, and he said, geez, look at the state of us. And I said, sure, no one had a pot to piss in. And he goes, yeah, but the reason we were grand was because nobody had a pot to piss in. Mm. Like, it just would have taken one person in that group to actually have a better life, and it would have ruined it for all of us.
Have a bigger pot, and, or any pot.
Yeah. Ooh, look at you with your pot. it was like, it was good, but it was, well, like, there was a resilience in where I grew up as well, in Carrick and Lish, like that people just got on with it. You know what I mean? And they were some of the most generous people I've ever met, and still to this day have ever met. And they're the guys that will put their hand in their pocket for every charity and every. And so it was a great environment from that point of view. And like, I saw the local entrepreneurs, what they did. Like, they weren't called entrepreneurs, they were called shopkeepers and whatever else. And they built their own credit union, and then they built their own community center and got no money from the government. This is like back when. So they did amazing things. So that was an interesting one. And then I went to CBS Exon Street for secondary school, which again, an interesting one, like ended up being ranked as one of the worst schools in the country, like that the only hope for it was to shut it down. And I kind of got thrown out of there. So that's a claim to fame, you know what I mean? That like kicked out of the worst school in Ireland. But no, I think what happened there was, like, primary school was grand, but secondary school, like, so I'm dyslexic, but I was like, there was no dyslexia when we were younger. You know what I mean? It was like, you were lazy, basically, was how they looked at it. But I knew I wasn't lazy. So there was an element to that as well, that I was kind of, so I always had part-time jobs, and I was always tipping away and trying things and selling stuff and up to no good. And so I ended up leaving school in fifth year, just couldn't, like, just school just wouldn't work for me. And it, obviously, it wasn't a great school, so as in, like, they just had like other problems, you know what? Yeah. I mean, it was more like it was crowd control rather than schooling, right? So, and that was tough, and I didn't fit in. Like, so I felt like I was acting a Mickey, like, sure, of course you're going to deal with him in a not so nice way. So that was tough. And then I ended up going back, and then I left again, and then I did the leaving on my own for a finish. And that was grand. And that worked. I was able to do it. And that was grand. Another school let me sit it there. Actually, two schools, because of the subjects I was doing. I ended up sitting my leaving between two schools. By the way, at the time, that seemed totally normal, right? To me, it as a thing to ask. Like, when I look back at it now, I've no idea even how they did that. You know what I mean? How the schools between them said, yeah, grand, sit your exams and don't go to school. But so that was that. And then I got into art college, and I got into UL here in Limerick. So, and obviously I wouldn't have been going any further afield. I wouldn't have been able to afford to go anywhere else. So it was it was a funny one. My mom stepped in at that stage, I think, and kind of had a word and went, here, come here. You don't be going to UL, like, which is a very unusual thing for a mother to say, like, don't study engineering in UL, go to art college. But her thing was like the last number of years have been hell. For all of us. So, you know, you love art, and we kind of discovered it later in life, was really into design and building shit. I was always making and breaking stuff. And so got into that whole art school side of thing. So went to Limerick School of Art and Design, best decision I ever made.
Wow.
And really, like, art college is like, it's 4 years of learning to be self-critical, realistically. Like, day one, you're up there, you're putting your stuff on the wall. And at the beginning, your classmates are going, yeah, I don't like this. And you develop a really thick skin, which is great. Mm. But eventually you kind of develop the skills to do that yourself without someone else having to put it on, you know, without having to put it on the wall. And it's a great discipline. Like, they really should teach that type of thing broader. And the other thing you start to do is you build up a portfolio of work. And that becomes a three-dimensional picture of a person, rather. So you're coming out into the world with, like, color, right? You're not, it's not a CV. You've color. Here's stuff I built. And I was big into that. So I ended up, especially, I thought I wanted to be a painter. I didn't have the patience for that. So I ended up doing graphic design. And that was around, the dot-com boom was kicking off in the late 90s. And so I started building websites. And so I would have probably then been, if I went to UL, I'd have been the, what the hell, who's your man? Like the arty fella. Whereas in the art college, I was the nerd, you know what I mean? And so I started building websites and really liked that. I liked the idea that you could have an idea and turn it into something with code. And like my approach to coding was always very much like, I only learned enough. I was a real hacker. Like, it was like, okay, I'd see something I liked, so I'd unpackage that and try and use it myself. I wasn't into proper coding where, that the big boys do, that kind of way. And that always kind of worked for me. And from there, I kind of got into software and front-end development. And that was kind of how I ended up. I met a couple of entrepreneurs. My only experience of an entrepreneur and what the hell that was one teacher in school who was obsessed with JP McManus because he went to CBS as well. And he used to call him an entrepreneur. And actually, a funny one with him, and I only thought of it recently talking to someone for an interview, and he used to do this kind of around the class, accountant. He'd tell people what they were going to be. And he was right, actually. The lad that does our accounts right now was one of the guys he pegged as an accountant.
Self-fulfilling prophecy, maybe.
Yeah, so he was really good at it. He'd be like, accountant, bricklayer, whatever. And then he got to me and he said, criminal or entrepreneur, only time will tell. And and it could have gone either way. I think it's similar assets for either. But yeah, so I met these two lads who had basically, they built a company, Suguru Brothers. They built a company. They were one of Ed Walsh's first spin-outs from UL. They were both lecturers in UL. They built that company, raised venture capital back in the 80s, right? Sold it like to a Swiss multinational in 92, started in 86, sold it. Like, no one I knew or heard of had ever done any of that. Like, I knew nothing about any of this. And basically, long story short, they came back together in around 2000, 2001. They were coming back together to go again. So they, after they sold the company, they went off and did their own thing. And I was their first employee, which I didn't even understand, right? But they had kind of learned the hard way. They were tech, deep tech guys. They'd learned the hard way that, like, in the first business, they were building the hardware from the ground up. When they were going again, they were going, fuck that. Leave that to someone else, deal with that. We loan the front end. We loan what the customer sees. And so that they kind of saw that in me. So I went off with them, moved off to France. Owen lived in France and the other brother lived in Russia. So I kind of split my time between France and Russia for the next couple of years.
How did you get started with them, though? That's such a random departure. How did you get intro to them, or how did that come about?
I swear to God, they came into the art college and went, here, is there any lunatics in here? And they went, oh, we know just the guy.
We have honestly, just the guy for you.
I'm just the guy. There's something not right about this one. Have a look at this. And they kind of went, yeah, he's our guy. Yeah, it was. It was weird. It was weird. At the time, it didn't feel like, I know, when you look back at your own life, it's very strange, right? And there's so much serendipity and weird shit that goes on. But like at the time, it was like, yeah, of course they'd want to hire me. Why wouldn't they? When I look back, and I'm like, going, I have no idea. Like, and I'd have had a confidence, I suppose, to build stuff and that kind of thing. I think I always saw the potential of what I could do rather than where I was. And I do think that's a dyslexic mindset as well, which can be really damaging, because especially if you don't fulfill what you taught, because you're always trying to catch up with your own thoughts, you know what I mean? But I think they saw a bit of that in it, and it was good fun. And I was always into sales, so I worked in shops all the way through. My dad was a salesman, so I'd always worked. So again, the boys were animals for sales. Like they were, you know, they were very customer focused, and like we built that company up. Like there was 8 of us, I think, and like we 25 million turnover in the first couple of years. Like after just like 3 years, our annual turnover was 25 million. It was mental.
When was that, Barry?
That was in kind of 2002 to kind of I was doing that like for 10-11 years on and off, as the man says, because I did a few spin-offs then as well, and was so anytime we created a tech, we kind of spun it off to the side. And so I got to play a bit of entrepreneurship with that as well, and raise money in that, and hired in management teams and all that fun stuff. So that was good as well, because obviously I learned from the boys, right? I learned what I liked about what they did, but I learned what I didn't like as well, that if I was going myself. Then I got to do the side bits, right? Again, now, this sounds like a plan. It wasn't. This just happened, right? I got married. I had kids. There was no plan, trust me. It was just blah, right? But it was always trying to follow what I enjoyed, right? So it was like, I like building stuff. I need to do this. Okay, you can do a spin out. You know, that kind of way. Mm. And then that kind of went on. And then after a while, I kind of went, hang on a minute. I'm never going to be able to build the business I want to build doing it this way. So we had a sit down with the guys. It was kind of two of us who'd come in as shareholders, and then the two founders, original founders. And we had a come to Jesus meeting and kind of said, look, I said, I want to do this. There's an opportunity in Millimeter Wave. There's an opportunity to build a hit out of Europe, which was a company at the time that I really liked. And I said, you know, I want to do that. And you want in? And they went, you know what? We're not, like, that's not for us. Like, this is building product from the ground up. So we separated at that time. And that's what set up Aralis, which was my last company. And it was myself and Mike, the other lad who'd come in. And Mike, we'd set up in China during the Midian days. And I went out and lived there. And Mike lived there for a bunch of years. So he spoke fluent Chinese and all that fun stuff. So we'd all that kind of experience under our belt. And so we went off and set up Aralis then. And
what was the original, what was the idea you were leaving with?
Yeah, it was okay. So, like, without boring anyone too much, right? So, like, everyone knows what microwaves are because they cook their dinner, right? Millimeter waves are just a higher frequency, right? And they've been used by the military, you know, for the last 40 years, right? So, missiles and things like that all operate in millimeter waves. So, they've got some really nice properties and they got some really pain in the ass properties, right? So, if we could use them, we'd never have used microwaves, right? They're difficult to deal with, right? But there's loads of bandwidth and all that fun stuff up there because no one else was operating up there. And I was looking at kind of 5G, and I was looking at autonomy, and because autonomy wasn't just in the car space, helicopter landing systems, all that fun stuff. Everyone wanted, space agencies want to be able to land landers without people. So this was coming over the horizon, right? A millimeter wave was the obvious place to do it, right? So you needed millimeter wave if you were going to solve the 5G and radar problem, right? So what basically I was looking at is, okay, how do we get that tech that's used by the military that they might drive around in a horse box size unit into something that you can use in the palm of your hand? And literally that was the idea, was like, put millimeter waves onto chips. Let's build it that it can be a handheld technology, that it can be deployed from ubiquitously from comms into helicopter landing systems and eventually into vehicles and everything else. So that was it. Like, and it was just, and being the, so we started off wanting to be the chip guy, right? So we'll be the guy that, you know, we'll get that technology from the horse box to the chip, right? But then chips at that level, they're interesting to say the least, right? But the problem then we discovered is no one knew what to do with the chips, right? So we were saying, like, no one deals with millimeter waves because the chips don't exist. But when the chips exist, there was, again, US was different. It was a bit more sophisticated, but we were the hit out of Europe, not US. So then we started building modules, which was integrating them, making them easier to use. And slowly but surely, we were building out. And like, that company is still going. I sold it a couple of years later, but they're still going. And basically now that company does the full system, right? Mm. Because that frequency is so difficult to work with that you really do have to sell people solutions rather than the chips. And the marketplace just gets bigger and bigger as you do the full solution. So that was kind of the thinking. That was why we set up Aralis.
How do you go from wanting to be a painter to developing chips like that? Even listening to you, I'm like, how do you even begin that journey? Was that self-taught through working with the lads?
It's a big advantage not understanding how dumb you are in that space, right? The other side of it was being with really smart people, like really smart. Like, so in the early days, like one of the previous spin outs I did was a spin out from, we did it with Queen's University in Belfast, who had a high frequency group there that's still, you know, one of the world leaders. So again, bunch of PhDs in this space, and being comfortable enough to go in and ask them lads dumb questions. Because the thing people don't realize is no one asks the PhD a dumb question, right? Mm. And so they don't think about dumb questions. So they don't think about the application of what they do. They're just trying to solve a physics problem, right? So that's really, I think, what I was doing, was kind of going in going, could I use that for this? And 9 times out of 10, they go, oh my God, you're such a moron. But every 1 in 10 time they go, actually, that's not totally stupid, right? Yeah. And so, but obviously you do need to understand a certain level. And I did, one of the ways I did end up learning quite a bit about millimeter waves was when I was living in China, we went for the Olympics in China. They were putting up these satellites, right, for weather forecasting, because they were going to cloud seed. Like, not a lot of people realize that, but like literally Beijing changed their weather so that it would be sunny for the Olympics, right? So they were seeding the clouds, making it rain so that it was always sunny when there was a thing on. So you need satellites to predict the forecast. And so there was a project came up to build a primary standard, right? So like, you've the meter in France and that's a meter or whatever. So you've these standards that it's like, okay, so what's absolute zero for testing radiometers, which is how you do weather forecasting. So China didn't have a national standard. So we put in a bid, right? And basically, I looked at what NIST had done in the US, the National Standards Institute in the US, looked at what they're doing and kind of recreated a drawing of it and kind of went, probably cost around that, put that in, and we won the shagging thing. And so I wasn't that worried, because I just went out to the smart people and went, hey, I now need to fulfill this. And the smart people all went, you're on your own, mate. So that was an interesting one. So that time I had to learn a little bit about millimeter waves, because no one wanted to deal with it. And to be fair, then eventually got it to a stage where some of the smart people went, okay, this actually might work. And they came in and so that is still the national standard in China. So every radiometer that goes into space is tested on that national primary standard made by a bunch of Irish lads that didn't know what they were doing. So, yeah.
I think there's a whole podcast episode on what you just said in the last 3 minutes there.
Again,
we're going to have to do round two on that.
At the time, it seemed perfectly normal. I get the sweats now thinking back on it. You know what I mean? And that's the problem, by the way. As you get older, you realize how little you know, right? It's really not like, and that it's funny with the whole, like you mentioned Tesla ever beforehand, you know, and that whole idea of being on Mount Stupid and having a little knowledge is probably the most dangerous thing you can have. And that's unfortunately where most in the autonomous industry, that's where most lay people are. They have a little knowledge and they're at the peak of kind of Mount Stupid. And unfortunately, it's when you come down here, you're, oh God, there's a real problem to solve here. Mm. And so I spent way more time in that valley of doom these days, because I've learned from a bunch of other things. And so when I think about my time back on Mount Stupid, I get the sweats.
I think most entrepreneurs need that level of naivety when you start. Because if I knew what I knew now, I'd never have started. Like it's bonkers. You need that kind of to be able to suspend belief and go, right, I have a great idea.
Yeah. I know, but then you think back on those meetings you went into as if you were the expert, and you go, oh God, no. And that, what worries me is like, oh, someone is thinking of something that I haven't even thought about on this whole space. But anyway, you can't think about that stuff, or you'll never do anything. I mean, that's paralysis right there. You know?
Yeah, I think the curious mind is key.
We'll be back to today's guest in just a second. In the meantime, I want to highlight a great new Irish business. I'm taking a segment each week now in the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast and highlighting a great new Irish business that started in the last 12 to 24 months. Give them a little bit of a shout out, help them on their early stage of the journey. So here is today's Irish business.
Hey guys, Keith Jordan here from Jordan Fitness Tullow. Just to tell you a bit about Jordan Fitness. I started Jordan Fitness 2 years ago. I've been training for the last 10 years myself in weights and martial arts in the last 5 or 6 years. As a kid, I was really skinny, couldn't put on weight, always sick, got meningitis. Finished that, after I got over that, I joined the gym, started bulking up, putting on some weight, and fell in love with the gym and all things around it. And now I preach what I learn on a daily basis. We run a variety of classes here at Jordan Fitness: Pilates, power pump, jiu-jitsu, self-defense, martial arts. We also cater for schools. We go in and teach kids self-defense in schools from 5 all the way up to adults. If you would like to hear more, please jump onto our Instagram and Facebook page. We also offer online training, so we can bring the training directly to your home or your dream anywhere in the world.
If you are an Irish entrepreneur and you've started a business in the last 12 to 24 months, reach out to me, contact me via the pod, and I'll do my best to highlight you on season 6 of the Entrepreneur Experiment. Now back to today's chat. How did you end up moving to China?
We all our eggs were kind of in the Russian basket. So we were doing a lot of test systems for into Russia because they were getting their electronics industry back up and running. So if you're doing so, that was kind of, that was our key market. And then we started doing projects in places like Uzbekistan and that. And then Mike came on board, and Mike had been doing test standards in China for years. He'd lived out there. And so he came on board and went off to China, and I ended up moving there because it was just so Mike had been working for a big brand. And so he thought, you know, okay, now I'll go in as a medium. But sure, everyone was like going, who the fuck are you, right? So suddenly it was like, so it was different. So basically I moved out there to give Mike a hand. And that took just over a year till we got our first order. And I literally left about 2 weeks after we got our first order. Like, now, not that I was key to getting the order, but it was like, okay, I'm done. Or my wife was done, that's for sure. But yeah, it was good fun though. Like Shenzhen back in 2004, 2005. It was the Wild West. It was great fun. It was like, you know, but it was good fun in one way. But like in the other way, we were selling into China. Like what most people think of China as sourcing, right?
Yeah.
And so Liam Hayes and PCH were a much smaller company then, but they were there. So all my mates were basically working for PCH and going, why don't you just work for PCH? And they were all out on the Friday night and happy out. Like, we've had a great week because they had the money. They were buying from China, and the Chinese were going, oh, we love you guys. Whereas we were selling to them. And basically whoever holds the money in China is the boss, right? So basically I was the bitch and they were the boss. So it was a very different Friday night experience. You know what I mean? We were all drinking for different reasons. But that was fun. Like, look, what do you learn? Like, you know, even doing projects with Huawei when they were a tiny company in Shenzhen. You know
really?
What I mean? Look at them now. And that stuff, like, you can't take that stuff back. That's cool. Because as well, like, China was a cheap place to make product back then, and got to kind of see it over the next number of years become the best place to make product. And people don't realize that now. Like, they've the best of kit, they've the best of techniques, they're making the best products, right? They're making iPhones. They're ahead. Like, and that was an amazing transition to see. And so yeah, that was a bit of fun, and did a few side projects while I was there as well, which was a bit of fun.
And what brought you back?
At that time, I was getting married and having kids. They decided, so my wife was with me. She was with me in France, or all that fun stuff, like in Australia. We did, I skipped Australia there. Did a year in Australia as well in the middle of all that. And we decided to get married and move back. Like, we probably had, and I probably wanted to get a handle on it a bit more as well, what we were doing in the company, and kind of started to think about more strategically me long term. And that started the process to kind of me taking more of a central role in Omidyon, and I became CEO after a couple of years of moving home and stuff, and kind of taking more responsibility. But it was probably that, going starting a family and building a house and all those boring things. And it's like, yeah, like, traveling around the world is great fun and all, but, you know, eventually you do want to put down roots somewhere, you know.
When you came back, you went to Limerick?
Yeah. I think you do return to what you know, you know. And back to Limerick, and I'd struggled big time. Like, to be fair, my wife was probably more enthusiastic about moving back than I was. So it was definitely a bit of a struggle for me in the beginning, because I just thought like I'd lived in the south of France, then moved to China. So you're like going, come on, like the lifestyle you have, yeah. And then going back to Limerick. But once I kind of got over myself and embraced things a bit, it was a lot better.
So you were able to set up a base for the company there? Or were they always?
Yeah. So it was Limerick headquartered from the beginning.
Okay.
Yeah. So but there was no one here. We were kind of all over the place. You know what I mean? We were where the customers were for the first number of years. And we probably got to a stage then where it was okay to be in the back office. You know, that kind of way.
What is it like building a company outside of the main kind of centers? People always talk about, you know, Dublin, London, New York, San Francisco, as if they have to be there. Without being there, it's never going to be a success. What do you see it as, an advantage or disadvantage?
I think it is a disadvantage in some ways. It depends how you measure it, right? Like, everything is how you measure it. And it's a big thing in startups, right? You put the graphs into your pitch deck, right? And it's basically you've scouted around for 10 months working out what metric actually makes your piece of crap startup look good, right? That's the reality of it. And that, you can do that with everything, right? There's stats that can show anything being good. But the reality is, if you have a Limerick company, Limerick headquartered company, it's not going to be valued as highly as a Silicon Valley one, right? But the trade-off is, hiring people isn't going to be easy. They're going to cost an awful lot more. A mid-sized outcome for a company here with Irish investors or European investors is a much happier place than that same outcome in Silicon Valley, right? So there's all different metrics you can measure it by. So I kind of went with the, well, what do I want to do? So like, even with Arala, so for the first couple of years we were here, when we kicked off in America, like, family, kids, boom, we're gone. Let's go. We're off to LA. So we were moving. So we did 3 months in LA, and then we came back for 3 months, and then we were moving out full time into January. But we just ended up selling the company, right? In the bit in between, we ended up selling the company. So then ended up moving to Vienna, as it turned out. It was meant to be moving to Hong Kong, and then last minute they bought some company in Austria, and we ended up moving to Vienna. So that's kind of, and to be fair, like, my wife's good like that in terms of, like, you know, like China was a whim. Like, China was myself and Owen having a pint on a Friday evening after work, and he's going, like, it's you know, it's a real struggle for Mike. It's really tough. And he went, would you move to China? And I went, yeah. And he was like, all right, when? And I was like, so next week.
How many pints deep were you at that stage? That's the key.
Not that many, actually. And like, I went home. Think about it. Like, I went home on a Friday evening and said to my wife, how do you feel about moving to China? And she was like, oh yeah, grand. And I was like, how about Monday? Like, and this is 3.5 years living in France, right? And she's like going, yeah, cool. Yeah. So we moved to China, one bag on our back again, same as we arrived in France, same as we arrived in Australia. One bag, moved to LA, one bag in the back. How are we doing? Moved to, you know, literally it went from Hong Kong to Vienna in a week. Like, we had said goodbye to everyone, said we're moving to Hong Kong, and the next thing we were living in Vienna like a week later. And it was like, grand. So I was lucky in that regard with my wife and stuff as well, that she was kind of down with the bonkers of the whole thing, you know.
How did that switch come about, that sale, I suppose? How did that all come about so quickly?
Yeah, it was funny. We were raising our Series A in Arales. And what I would say we had was, we had something that could scale to a certain level. And especially with going to America, I got a real eye-opener on that, right? I could see where we could get to, and then where the market could end up, right? So to get to the ultimate outcome would have involved raising a hell of a lot of money and surviving a lot of years, right? Because it was real early stage tech. So that was grand. We were out raising our Series A. We had a bunch of offers from both corporates and VC, and like, of course, like, nothing was ever good enough for me, right? Which was, you know, a pain in the ass as well. So like, corporates loved us, right? Corporate money. So like, let's say Airbus's corporate division or Boeing's investment division will go, yeah, like, you know, I wore a tie. They were like, yeah, you weren't near his events. Great. Like, we'll invest, right? And then Sandhill Road was kind of going, yeah, I don't know. Like, this seems a bit of a stodgy old industry. So, of course, then I was like, oh, you will invest. You know, I will ram this company down your mouth. So there was a bit of that going on. And I came home and one thing I discovered when I came, I had two really good non-execs in Neuralis, non-executive directors, Pat O'Sullivan Green and Eamon Ryan. Really experienced lads. And I came back, chatted to them, and I remember having a coffee with Eamon Ryan, and there was definitely a sense that I was Napoleon without an army. I'd gone off and I was doing my thing, and I was going raising big money in the US, and the whole company was going to change. And after that, I had a meeting with Mike, who was my co-founder, but 20 years older than me, right? And at Eamon's beckoning, I had a chat with him. And I said, just at the end of the meeting, I kind of went, and he was like, yeah, I'm cool with what you're doing. It's all good. We're okay. And I said, if we could sell this tomorrow, would you? And he said, oh God, yeah. And like, this is like the other 50% of the company, yeah?
Was that back to your mind, or was that something you just threw out there to see what he'd say?
It was based on the coffee conversation, right? I had with Eamon, and it was to see where was he on this whole journey. And it was understandable. Like, when I think back at the time, it was like, what? And again, whims, there you go. I said, well, one of the companies that had offered to invest in us was Hong Kong Private Equity Group. And we said no, because we were doing a lot of work in the US, and we kind of were going, if we have, you know, Hong Kong, Chinese money on the cap table, it could be awkward, right? And so I text them and see
the text.
And yeah, really, hey lads, honestly.
Hey lads, you up?
Yeah. Do you want, and that was why he texted. They weren't up. And it was my wife's anniversary. We went out for dinner that night. And what did I just say? My wife's anniversary. It was her birthday. Sorry, it wasn't her anniversary. We share our anniversaries together. God, anyway, it was my wife's birthday. We went out for dinner that night. And at dinner, I got a text back. And it literally said, they said, yeah. And that was it. Now, the next couple of months were hell, getting the sale over the line, doing all that fun stuff, because, you know, negotiating with Hong Kong guys is a bit of crack. And then, you know, you're also internally negotiating with your own investors. But we got there. So literally the company was sold on its third anniversary that January.
Wow. It's only gone 3 years. It's only gone 3 years.
Yeah, wow. Exactly. So we'd set it up a year earlier while we were still in the Midian, but we kind of left. Yeah, we both finished up. Mike moved back from China in like January 2014, and the sale went through in like second week in February in 2017. Yeah, it didn't feel sharp, by the way, Gary. Yeah. Like, it felt like 70 years, right? But yeah, it was a quick one. And that's key as well to like selling at that stage. Obviously, if we'd raise a Series A, it changes that, because that outcome isn't going to be the same for anyone. And we knew that as well. So we kind of had to make a quick decision. And they knew it as well. You know what I mean? The acquirers, they knew, look, these guys raised, we're going to be paying an awful lot more money. And they wanted it. So it was done. And yeah, it was a funny one.
What did that feel like for you, Barry?
Oh God, here's okay, initially, all right, there was a lot of relief, right? Obviously, because, you know, we were balls in, by the way. We hadn't an absolute, like, when I think back on that as well, and it's that kind of, you know, the precarious position I put my family in, but had this belief we were going to do it, and I borrowed to do it and all that fun stuff. So, you know, like up to me nuts in debt and all that fun stuff. So there's that initial relief and all that fun stuff. And then I, like, obviously I was staying with the company as well, and they were backing us. Like, they weren't going, we're buying it and it's going to be now called Global Megacorp. It was still going to be Neuralis. They just wanted to be silent and me to run the company. So there was an element of that, and I was going, right, Grant. So I was very clear about, right, okay. And they were investing and all that. But I went into a bit of a depression, which is a very strange thing to do. But yeah, I got really, really down. It was like, I don't know what it was. My dad had died in the middle of the journey, so he didn't get to see the outcome, right? Yeah. So that was weird. So he kind of died just a year before. So there was dealing with that. And then there was just the, right, so I had so many chips on my shoulder, right? Like, I was heavily motivated. I was going to show everyone wrong, right? So the teachers had said I was a piece of shit. I was going to ram it down their throat. Forgetting, of course, like, now in my 40s, I go, you know, they didn't care, right? They don't care what I'm doing, right? And most of us wish people well anyway, even if we thought they were an asshole in school, right? But I had so many chips. That was the only balance I had, right? And then when the universe kind of rewards you, that was really unsettling for me. So it took me a while to just get comfortable with that whole thing. I was really uncomfortable with money as well. All my life, I never had a comfort. Like, I was never doing it for money, right? I did want to, you know, do okay. Like, it was a measuring stick, but it didn't kind of define me. So then that, like, and I think, you know, when you're poor, right? Like, it's different, right? So I see, like, people that come from middle classes or whatever else that have made money, like, they're way more comfortable with it. Like, but whereas I was like, the instant fear that came in was like, oh God, I'm going to screw this up and be broke again, right?
That's really interesting. That's really interesting that's how you
thought. I'd rather never have been well off than to be the guy that was and then blew it. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I'd seen from afar the boom and bust in Ireland. There was all this stuff in my head. It's really uncomfortable. Like, it was like one of the most depressing days of my life was when my financial advisor said, "You okay, so you don't have to work anymore. What's next?" And I'm going,
was it a feeling of what now? What's it all for?
And it was like, I think Irish people maybe more so, and I think Irish working class people, like, you define yourself by your job.
Yeah,
absolutely. What you do, like, it was like, you could be anything, but you had to do something, you know what I mean? It was like, there was none of this, like, it's different. I see now, like, with my kids, they ended up in private school for a while and that, like, those kids are completely fucking different. Their parents are telling them, like, you know what I mean? You can be a dancer, you know what I mean? Like, we didn't grow up with that, right? So it's like, yeah, you can fucking dance on a Saturday night in nightclub and then you go to work on a Monday, right? So it was all that going on, and it was tough. Yeah, it's tough. Sorry. This is Jesus, if anyone heard me, but it was weird. It took me a long while, and it was good. I was over in, which was great. I wasn't in Ireland. There was no scrutiny. It was kind of done quietly. They kind of, and it was an investment as they were concerned. So that's how they dealt with it from a PR perspective. And it was grand. I was over there and I threw myself into the work, like travel like an absolute idiot. I had been always anyway, but it was even worse. And that kind of got me through. But look, eventually after a while, I kind of got comfortable with myself and all that fun stuff. And said, right, is this really what I want to do for the rest of my life? Work for these guys in the market that they're doing. The opportunity that getting that exit velocity in your 30s, you know, it would be a shame not to do something with that. And that's kind of then when I moved towards finishing up and promising my wife that 6 months, I will not do anything. I will not start any companies. And
was that the agreement, was it? 6 months.
That was the agreement.
That was your golden handcuff deal with her, was it?
Exactly that. Yeah, just 6 months. Just relax. And sure, what did I do? Sure, I threw myself into loads of other stuff then. Like, sure, the problem is like busy people will always be bloody busy. Yep. You know what I mean? So I ended up getting stuck in every bloody board and charity known to man. So it was nearly a relief to go back to work after 6 months. And of course, I started tinkering with Provisio. Like, she said I couldn't start any companies, but she didn't say I could. Yeah.
That brings us beautifully onto Provisio. I was going to say, did you have the hunger? Did you? What made you start again? I think you've kind of already answered that in terms of it's just innate in you. It seems to be just, that is how you're built.
I'm a bit weird on that one, right? Because I did just talk about how I felt after selling the company. And I'm convinced that entrepreneurship is very much a mental illness.
That's not the first time that's been mentioned. Interesting enough, that is not the first time. I heard it described as an addiction and an illness, and very common that comes up.
Yeah, and it's funny, doing okay in a few bits, you start to meet fellas who've done well, and like a few mates who've done very well, and you know, late night having a pint, would you take the blue pill that stopped this feeling of wanting to build and wanting to create and do all that? And a lot would, you know what I mean? And I wouldn't be too far away from them. So it is like it, there is that little, so I'm trying to be less manic. I'm trying to be less like, oh, I'm going to build something and change the world. And so even with Provisio, honestly, I wasn't like the 6 months thing. I can joke about it, but I actually, it had to be something that had a bit of meaning for me to go again.
Okay.
And like, this was the obvious one. It was like, this industry is screwed, like, right? And nobody is taking the right approach as far as I was concerned.
Where did you see it? Can you, where was that initial spark of an idea going, oh, there's something there?
It was like, as I say, in Erasmus, we were working on one of the big autonomy programs, and they were the best, right?
Yeah.
And I'm going, this A isn't going to happen, but B, the tech isn't scalable. It's too expensive. Like, we were putting aerospace radars on it. They were costing a fortune. That was never going to be on an ordinary person's vehicle. And so, but as well, obviously, we had to solve the edge cases. We were there to solve the edge cases. We got to see these are the things can't solve. And so they're never going to be on the road. So that was the insight. And so kind of went from there into, okay, how could you solve that? And could we do that? And that approach, so what people kind of, so the advanced driver assistance systems and emergency braking is around for 20 odd years, right? But what happened is all the investments, and it was well researched, well invested, When autonomy came along, all the money went into that. Like, there's over $100 billion invested in autonomy over the last number of years, right? That's money that didn't go into advanced braking systems and advanced driver assistance systems. So that was the other side of it. It was kind of gone. So that actually hasn't developed, right? So the emergency braking system in your car is still crap, right? The advanced driver assistance is still rubbish, right? So really, what I was kind of looking at is, let's get that focus back there and see that as a path to that. And I think that, and that mission side of things I got into, and the guys that I, like, as I say, I went out and I put it in front, my idea in front of Smart Lads, and I was hoping almost in a way that they'd say, no, that's a stupid idea, Barry. But when they didn't, okay, we went with it and set up the company. So, but definitely trying to build something that's more balanced, less manic, less like thinking a bit more, being a bit more circumspect, raising enough money that you're not worried too much about the next funding round, that you can actually solve. So, and then very honest with customers. So I'm kind of enjoying it a bit more because, like, again, I've discovered that over time as well, like, just total honesty, not doing the reality distortion feed, not the, you know, saying to a customer, yeah, we won't be there for 6 months. And letting the conversation end there and going back in 6 months, and they're going, that was 6 months, that flew. You know what I mean? That kind of, so, and as well, like, with the people coming in with me, trying to build a company like that, that you can have a life, that you can have kids, that you can, you know, this idea has startups flogging themselves to death. And, you know, it's like my days of doing 250,000 miles in air miles a year are gone. Like, that's just not, and that's not like me being lazy. That's like me going, what kind of an idiot does that? You know, that's just to get to work. That isn't smart. That you're not looking at, okay, what's the utility I'm getting from this? How many orders did that convert into? You're just doing. So probably trying to be a bit smarter this time, trying to build a place that people will enjoy. And that's probably suited, and with COVID hitting, because we were built that way, we probably were built in a way to survive COVID, I think, the better than others.
What are you building that's different? You mentioned there you're building a company that people want to work in, and that's, it's a healthy balance. What have you installed to kind of help that happen?
Yeah, so like a big thing is, obviously, we were remote from the beginning because we'd lads in Pittsburgh, we'd lads in Belfast, we'd ourselves in Limerick, and then other people. So that was the first thing, was built in that regard. So if you needed to work from home, you needed to be with your kids, like, you just don't have to turn up at a meeting. That was, from the beginning, that was just a very simple thing of, like, you know, you don't need to be seen to be busy. Just do your job. Let's have fun, right? And bring in people that want to do that. The other thing we built in was kind of from day one as well, is I've been kind of doing this experiment of trying to encourage the bits that people are really bad at. There's two parts. One part is, we're a safety company for vehicles, right? And an awful lot of people crash because they sleep driving, things like that, right? And they don't have that. So, like, we brought in a bunch of programs in the company from the beginning. And if you participate in them, the reward is time off, right? So we have a fitness program. So you, and we all wear these MAPS belts, and you go off and you get fresh air, and you go out and go for a walk or a run or whatever. We add up the scores. If you get the kind of what you should get by the WHO standards, you get an extra half a day a quarter, right? So basically there's kind of 2.5 days a quarter up for grabs. So the reward for looking after yourself is more time off that you have to take in the following quarter. And that's kind of been interesting because it creates a real sense of team as well, because everyone's doing it. So we're all, there's a bit of health competition on the maps, but then we have we've sleep monitoring. We've, again, before anyone was talking about the whole mental health thing, we've had that mental health side of things as well. So if you participate in it, so for example, if you are going for counseling, we'll pay for it, but we'll also give you extra time off because you've done that. So we got a bunch of these things that it's kind of, and we all have these driving monitors as well. So in other words, if you break the speed limit on a regular basis, you know, you lose. So we have this scoring chart. And so that's going quite well as well. And everyone's participating. And by the way, if you take public transport, you get the day off anyway. Right. So that's kind of the program. And it's been kind of cool. You know what I mean? Because it builds a sense of team, but also it gets across this thing of look after yourself. But an awful lot of companies do this, like, I hate this forced fun crack. I was never like, we all have to go and have a barbecue together on a Friday. And like, so for example, World Mental Health Day was a couple of weeks ago. And so the ideas came in and it was like, let's get everyone a bottle of whiskey or let's have an online Zoom thing. And we just like, lads, Friday, half day, go spend it with your real friends. And everyone was like, nice.
It's like, so simple. Like, it's so, and let's get them a bottle of depressive for the day for mental health day.
Exactly.
It's always overthought, or it's a tick the box exercise. We have CSR.
Like force fun. I can't deal with it.
Those programs are brilliant. I love that. The counseling piece is huge. I think that's absolutely massive. That should be for every company. I think what you're doing.
You know what? Beautiful. Just by having it, Gary, it creates an environment where people can talk about that.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And I think maybe, you know, I think enough of us are there as well that are know each other long enough as well that we can go, you know what? I'm fucking struggling at the minute. And it gets said in meetings and it's really nice. Like, I've never seen that in other companies because it was always that macho crap of like, I'm killing it.
Hustling hard. Yeah.
It's like, you know, especially, and now COVID happened, right? It wasn't designed around COVID. It was, we had that in there. And, you know, I think we've been lucky enough, like obviously, because everyone has trauma from COVID. It'll just come out at different times, right?
Absolutely.
And so I think, again, just being in that position where people can deal with that, I think is important. You know what I mean?
Brilliant. We're just about to wrap up. Can you just give me a flavor of where Provisio was heading?
Yeah. So again, like, so to solve the problem, right? There's two elements. First is we have to be designed into vehicles, right? So that is a process. It's a proven process for years. So basically, you know, BMW, Renault, whoever you buy your car from needs to design in our platform into their vehicles going forward, right? So we're in that process. We're going to partner with tier ones and OEMs and get our vehicles designed in. That takes time or whatever else. The other side of it then is the aftermarket side, which is kind of neglected, right? And that especially brings in fleets and trucking and all that fun stuff, because again, these are the quite unsafe vehicles that are on the road. And,
absolutely.
And that's where tiredness kicks in and all that fun stuff. So basically that's what we're doing. We're building a licensable tech that will go into everyone's vehicle at a price point that, you know, can go on every vehicle, not just the luxury model, which is a big problem with safety, right?
Yeah.
Safest cars are the most expensive cars. That isn't really fair. The aftermarket is where we're going to get our data as well. So these guys, they don't really play very well, like the big boys, the big OEMs. They don't like sharing data and all that fun stuff. The aftermarket is where we gather our data, develop our AI engines, our neural nets, train them, all that fun stuff. And then we'll compress that and sell it into that other industry. And that's really where it's at. So it is a big play. It's a long play. It's going to cost a bloody fortune. And look, we're breaking it down. We have our own milestones. Our milestones aren't set by our investors. Our milestones are set by ourselves. This is what we want to achieve. We're working through those. It's been going way too well up to now. We had some stuff blow up last week and I was never so relieved. Because I was really getting worried that nothing was done, you know. Because it'll always go, something will always go wrong.
You were due one.
new one, and at least it blew up in our office and not in our customers. So that was good. Like, that's the lads got a good kick out of me being so relieved the shit was on fire. So that's good. So there'll be some announcements coming, but again, we're here to kind of make our customers look really good. You know what I mean? And like, I'm really comfortable with that. Like that, you know, that the OEM can say we're building the safest vehicle on the road. I don't care if they never mention Provisio. Happy to be the guy inside there, because we'll do well if they do well. So so that's kind of where it's going, and probably just trying to influence the industry a little bit as well. And having chance, and it's been good because that approach has worked really well. Like literally every autonomous group, every vehicle manufacturer, we've talked to every one of them, and we've had very open and honest dialogues. Like I've nothing to hide. We're not trying to bullshit anyone, and they appreciate that as well. And that takes their guard down as well, and they start to tell you a bit about their problems, and that's it. So that's where we're going. It's who knows, you know what I mean? We'll either be going on an acquisition spree or we'll get fucking taken out of it in a couple of years, but that's the life.
You just got to come back on and tell me all about it. Barry, we've done 133 episodes, and that is by far one of the wildest stories we've ever had on. I absolutely loved
it. Now I'm getting worried, Gary. What did I say?
I absolutely loved it. That was a joy. That was literally an hour of just pure entertainment and just knowledge. Thank you so much, Barry. Where can people learn a bit more about Provisio?
Our website is provisio.ai. I think it's got like one line on it. Enjoy it. It's the most fabulous line on the internet. Yeah. So that's it. Sorry. We're like, you come and meet me. Like, I can't shut up when I meet you. But when it comes to like PR and marketing, I'm like, oh, we're done with that. I know. Look, it'll be coming out slowly. We've got some really cool, like we're doing data collection on the mule vehicles at the moment. It's like, in fairness to the lads, because I can't take credit for that. Like, they've built something just awesome, right? So that'll, as our customers start to talk about what they're doing, you'll start to see a bit of what we're doing, and that'll be cool. That's good enough for me, you know.
I have a funny feeling we'll be hearing a lot about it. Barry, thank you so much.
Cheers, Gary. Thanks for having me.
And that was episode 132 of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. Just to recap, if you want to win a ticket to the Dublin Tech Summit, share your favorite Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me on social media, and you'd be in with a chance of winning. I will see you back here next Monday for the Idea Lab. Until then, have a brilliant week.